Welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns. My name is Rosemary Truman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Center for Advancing Innovation, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have John Buchvar on the podcast today. He is fabulous. And by the way, Buchvar means to read a book. I just learned that. John has a wide range of different kinds of expertise. He's the head of the Brain Tumor Center at Lenox Hill. He's the vice chair of neurology. He's an investigator at the Feinstein Institute. He's had significant media attention on the Dr. Oz show, New York Times, Fox News, CNN, ABC, and the list goes on and on and on. And he has also won several awards for his surgical expertise, as well as humanitarian awards. There's much more to talk about with regards to John's background. Maybe, John, you could say a few more words about how did you get to where you are?
Well, I think, well, first of all, thank you, Rosemary, for inviting me. And this is such a terrific podcast. Having listened to all your podcasts, it's a great honor to join the roster of people that you've had on the show. So congratulations to you and others before me. One of the biggest things that drives me is tradition. And I come from four generations of physicians before me. My great-grandfather graduated Yale Medical School in 1903. Wow. And my grandfather and father followed. So it truly is part of my blood, where medicine was always part of my calling, and I knew from a very young age. And interestingly, I'm an identical twin, and my identical twin chose a path of law.
Wow.
We're a family of four, and two became doctors and two became lawyers. So as siblings, but we all are like-minded.
Well, that's very, very interesting background. So you have four siblings. We are six of us, and almost all of us are doctors. So not all MDs, but PhDs, MD mix. So you are a prolific inventor, and I'd love to know how many inventions have you created?
So I look at inventions as, you know, obviously tactile objects that you can invent, but also programmatic development, how you approach basic science. So I have structured my whole career about what I call the essentially quadruple threat: the clinician, the basic science researcher, the clinical researcher, and the educator. And so I look at any invention or discovery that I do in one of those four categories. I started out at Penn doing my postdoctoral fellowship, where my first real unique finding was looking at mutant EGFR signaling in glioma stem cells. And this was in 1998 when James Thompson and others were just publishing in Nature embryonic stem cells. And so the world was really rallying behind that, the stem cell biology world. And we applied that to glioma stem cells. And I was one of the first to look at EGFR signaling in the glioma stem cell population. And that really fueled my investigation into novel techniques to target stem cells in the human brain cancer patient population. Mm. So those early findings were extremely important in navigating me into the field. I went on to describe methods that were novel at the time of how do you harvest a stem cell from a brain cancer in a human. Those techniques we published, and it became an important part of the field is how do you isolate those stem cells because they're senescent or sleeping. Mm-hmm. When you give the treatments to patients, and that can predict when a patient's going to relapse. And that's a very important treatment problem. It led me on a path to understanding the blood-brain barrier, and that has become a passion of mine for two decades. And as you know, the blood-brain barrier is the holy grail of the human brain. And mm-hmm. if there's one thing that I hope from your work at CAI and the brain race and other challenges that you have is more and more people need to study the blood-brain barrier,
right?
Because it is an underlooked phenomenon because it's so difficult. The blood-brain barrier led me to techniques that I described in 2009 and 2011, where I was the first in humans to show that intra-arterial drug delivery using microcatheters to deliver monoclonal antibodies could be done successfully into the brain through the blood-brain barrier with techniques called blood-brain barrier disruption.
Hmm.
And we published those results in 2011, had a significant amount of grant funding. Again, this has been a snowball of my career, starting from the postdoctoral fellowship in glioma stem cell biology and rolling downhill to where now I have not the only trial in the world where we look at autologous tissue grafts from the scalp that we rotate into the brain to bypass the blood-brain barrier. The FDA just gave me approval to do 10 human patients.
Wow. We've done congratulations. Two.
Thank you. And you know how hard getting anything past any regulatory committee is like.
Yes.
And finally, just from a surgical perspective, I just got approval to take fat from your belly called omentum and rotate it and put it in the brain to bypass the blood-brain barrier. And there's a whole host of techniques. So those are the what I call clinical and surgical discoveries that I've made. And they're unique. I then started something called the Brain Tumor Biotech Summit when I was at Cornell because I felt frustrated that I would go to academic meetings of smart neurosurgeons and neuroscientists, and there was no business representative. There was nobody who was there from commercial entities, no investment people, no venture people. It was just a bunch of smart people in bow ties talking to themselves.
Right.
And then I would go to Cambridge or Silicon Valley and go to, you know, neurotech conferences. And there was nobody from academia. It was just people from venture talking to each other about schizophrenia and depression. So I found that frustrating, mostly for my patients who were struggling from brain cancer, and the neuro-oncology space in the biotechnology neuro-oncology space was very, very small. So I decided to start something which still remains unique in the world, the Brain Tumor Biotech Summit, and ultimately we became brick and mortar about 5 years ago, and I run now something called the Brain Tumor Biotech Center, which is based at the Feinstein Institute, and our main mission is not to make a profit, but to act to help small biotech in the neuro-oncology space and act like a cheap CRO where we can provide preclinical modeling, regulatory assistance, and then I can roll those patients, that company out in clinical trials in the state's largest health system, which is Northwell Health, across 24 hospitals in New York State.
That's incredible. So the you also participate in the brain race. The brain race is a challenge to improve outcomes for brain tumor patients, and you're a star team, three different entries, which is very exciting. I mentioned that because you have all of these other accomplishments. We're going to be sending all of these 20 new companies to get help from the Feinstein Institute. So they all will need your help.
Well, I always say this. I challenge my team. I say, I want to see every new brain tumor and old recurring brain tumor in the country, and we're well on our way to do that. We're so excited about the brain race. And the reason why I'm excited is because I've been fortunate enough to really recruit and travel with what I think is the best team of really smart, humble, focused, passionate researchers, scientists, nurses, neuroradiologists, you name it, just really compassionate human beings that are dedicated to help improve the lives of patients with brain cancer. Our company that you'll hear more about in the brain race is focused on what I'm passionate about, which is overcoming the blood-brain barrier. And we have a terrific pipeline of products and devices that we have discovered and used and leveraged our expertise, which is now 20 years of human and preclinical modeling, to hopefully make our drugs better at getting into the brain.
So how do you collect this group of talent? How do you inspire them?
That's a great question. And, you know, I've learned a lot about management, obviously vertical management, both up and down. First of all, it's the old adage my dad used to tell me, even playing Little League, is, you know, you're good at what interests you and you're interested in what you're good at. So I challenge my teammates, if you will, from everyone from a medical student to a nurse practitioner. I say, take 20% of your time to a passion project, much like Google does and other people, you know, other big Fortune 500 companies have done. But I really want them contributing. First of all, I give them time off. Many of these people have families. Medicine is becoming increasingly stressful and bureaucratic. My nurse practitioners at previous institutions, I've been at Penn and Cornell, worked 5 days a week. I changed that to 4 days a week. I think there's extreme value, and I learned this from my father, who took every Wednesday off to play golf, but I don't do that. But I do appreciate the time to sit and think, clean my inbox, think about novel techniques, address some passion of mine. And I inspire the team to do the same thing. I want them exercising, getting to the gym, getting home to feed the kids, and then spending some time coming up with some novel ideas. And just to give you an example, I had a nurse practitioner who came to work for me. She came from Columbia University, and she had a terrific idea that she wanted to pursue combining capecitabine and temozolomide for the treatment of glioblastoma. And that's a drug combination that we use in a different type of cancer. I said to her, go ahead, take the time. We'll cover your phones. We'll do whatever it takes. She wrote the protocol. We're the only site in humans now. I just got off the phone with a patient who decided to choose that trial over a vaccine trial at Duke for brain cancer. So, you know, these are the kind of things we want our people doing. I have another nurse practitioner that is interested in over-the-counter drugs for brain cancer. So her name is Cherise Fralin. She is looking at chloroquine, Celebrex, low-dose naltrexone, CMV drugs, diabetes drugs like metformin for glioblastoma. And that's her passion. I give her the time to do that. And I'm fortunate to be at an institution that believes in its people and believes in the value of time to be creative.
Yeah, and it also is clear to me that you believe in cultivating people, you know, listening carefully to them and understanding what they have to say at any level, because you see there's value to add.
I completely agree. I think some of it just comes from humanity. Look, I'm a parent. I have four children. I have to encourage them and discipline them, but I have to foster their innovation and excitement. And all of our family members in our brain tumor center are encouraged to think independently, to rely upon one another like a big family. And I think quality of life is an extremely important part of that success. We're only as good as my most miserable child. And you know, unless my staff is happy at work, and that comes from happiness at home, they can't be creative.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the mother of invention is? I mean, you've mentioned, how did these nurse practitioners come up with these ideas? Where do you think it starts from?
They're very inquisitive. So their curiosity, and, you know, perhaps, you know, we're in New York. So, you know, our slogan is, if you see something, say something. You know, everybody that I work with, I've kept around because they are inquisitive and they can see a problem. And they're also very engrossed in a problem and educated about it. And so they see something that's missing, an unmet need, for example, and they really capture that and try to address that problem. And I've done that. You know, I lost my father to cancer about 10 years ago to chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And immediately understood very quickly that the chemotherapies that basically he died from swine flu related to the chemotherapy he got. And so I immediately saw that as a major flaw in a treatment that a major cancer center here in New York had given the wrong treatment, and he had gotten swine flu, which he should have been swabbed for. So we look for problems, we look for unmet needs, and we fill those voids. And the people that I've kept around me have been people who have been curious like me.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned your passion project. I'm curious if you have another passion project other than passing the blood-brain barrier.
Well, look, my passion is the treatment of glioblastoma. And I look at every patient, and the blood-brain barrier is just one step, unfortunately, in the hurdle of treating brain cancer. The heterogeneity and the actual difficulty of the glioma biology itself is part of that. The project. And my passion project is, gosh, we have increased survival for glioblastoma 1 month per decade of research over the last five decades. And so I just came from seeing patients in the hospital, new patients that came in last night, and I had to look them in the eye and say, why are we doing so poorly against this disease? And one of them is the blood-brain barrier. The basic biology of this, the treatment, and the inadequacy of the drugs that we're designing, because there are too few drugs that are being trialed in glioblastoma. There are too few biotechnology companies involved in neuro-oncology, rightfully so. It's not an avenue that's been one that's generated excitement in the past. But again, these are human beings that are family members in the prime of their lives, and they're losing this battle.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we at the Center for Advancing Innovation, we work with more than 100 institutions across the United States and beyond. work with about 170,000 inventions, 500,000 patents, and we look exhaustively for inventions that can make a significant impact on human health. Part of what we do is we have agreements with a lot of technology transfer centers to gain access to these patented inventions and hopefully get them out into the world and launch startups around them. So we've launched about 300 startups over the last 3.5 years, and 200 of them actually are cancer-oriented. So I mentioned this to you because part of what we want to do in this podcast is try to improve our ability to advance technology rapidly. Technology that can truly make an impact, can cure, can improve outcomes. The purpose of the brain race is to improve outcomes. So we get the invention, it's a trifecta, we get the invention, we then launch a challenge. We have teams come into the challenge to launch companies, and then of course connect them with capital at the end to make sure that they are successful. What has your experience been in this realm of technology transfer and advancing inventions? Because I think personally, we spend $140 to $160 billion a year in our taxpayer dollars for doing research, and yet we have 0.01% of these inventions are transferred, which is a crying shame.
Yeah.
Enormous opportunity. Yeah.
Look, and again, I'm just going to give you my experience. I came from two Ivy League institutions that were, if I were to give their tech transfer ecosystems a grade, it would be a C+, maybe C at best. And the reasons for that is the bureaucracy. First of all, you have to understand how, and we're talking about healthcare, and I'm not necessarily talking about pharma and other, but if you talk about, physicians and surgeons and doctors are actually very innovative people.
Yes.
Very smart people. They understand biology better, and I interact with my basic scientists, but the basic scientists don't have that translational element to know what will work in humans. So really a huge source of the cure of human disease comes from the people in the front line, which are your doctors. Our healthcare systems now are so squeezed for operational income that there's not the extra funds for research. And so we all operate at about a 1% profit margin. And so there is no money for research. There used to be money actually 20 years ago. And I'm not even talking about NIH or NCI dollars right now. Mm-hmm. But in general, physicians are paid now. They are incentivized by relative value units, or RVU.
Mm-hmm.
And greater than 95% of doctors in academic medical centers are RVU incentivized. And that is a real problem. And that is a shift that's occurred over the last 10 years or so. And you are squeezing water out of stone from these doctors. And you're basically incentivizing them to do procedures or do office visits or order imaging, because each one of those has an RVU, a relative value unit, and that's how their contracts are structured. And that is a major problem with these academic centers. Now, if you are lucky enough to come up with an idea, the institutions are not really looking to spend a lot of money on IP protection. They're looking to do the least possible. And as you know, they're often the worst tech transfer offices. It's not like American Express, which is, putting out 10 patents per week.
Right.
These academic centers want to minimize the cost, and they really don't have the legal infrastructure to do a search on whether your invention is even a reasonable claim or not. So I would say more often than not, the atmosphere is very negative.
Mm.
There's no incentive, and our contracts are structured so unless you have a carve out when you start at a new hospital, the institution owns your IP. That's part of your contract.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to technology licensing and distribution of royalties, it's usually you get 30 or 40% of that income and the institution takes the rest. So again, not to minimize the importance of the academic center, but it de-incentivizes the individual at a lot of steps along the path.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways to potentially change that is to re-incentivize, first of all, restructure the contracts. I mean, there has to be an emphasis on allowing people to have some element of discovery and innovation, because you basically have just taken out your entire cohort of contributors to innovation in the whole physician pool. Physician burnout is at its highest rate ever now.
Mm.
About 60% of all physicians experience burnout. And it's a major problem as our population is aging. I think 95 million Americans will be above the age of 65 by 2050. We're not only losing the race when it comes to biotechnology, we're losing physicians at an incredible pace. So we have to really structure the hospitals, and certain hospitals are better than others. One of the reasons why I moved over to the Feinstein Institute, which is a birth child out of Rockefeller University here in New York, is it has that Rockefeller model of translational research, which is a much faster model of saying, okay, the science is good. Let's protect our science. Let's make a claim for the IP. Let's get this into humans. And for me, I needed that. The old school, stodgy, slower Ivy League institutions are a little bit slower at that tech transfer.
What are the incentives that you have in place to cultivate the creativity there?
Well, I was brought over because of my creativity. So I was mentored over 20 years ago by Kevin Tracy, who's the president and CEO of Feinstein, who started his own company called Setpoint Biomedical, which is a terrific company where you stimulate the vagus nerve with little stimulators to shut off the immune system for patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So here is just one example, and that came out, that early inflammatory reflex came out of his work at Rockefeller and then at the Picower Institute and now at Feinstein. So it's a model of taking good basic science research, protecting the intellectual property, and moving it into biotech and into humans and doing better for diseases that are devastating. So it's really the culture is correct. The incentives were correct. I don't have an incentive clause to do surgery in my contract. So I can look a patient in the eye and say, I'm doing your surgery because you need it, not because I need it.
You know, I guess I have a bigger picture question. There's all these challenges that we have at these institutions, and they're siloed. Each one does their technology transfer differently. Their processes are different. Their licensing agreements are different. The way they put their inventions on their websites are different. So discoverability can be different. The due diligence approach that they take to things are different. You know, if you were to look at a big picture transformation, do you have a perspective on what could we do to drive holistic change across the institutions to adopt the best practices like what you have where you are right now?
So, obviously, it's a terrific question, and I wish we can scale what we have at Feinstein into a federal program where under one roof, you submit your claim and with federal dollars, either there are regional or local outlets where you can have tech transfer offices that are really under the auspices of somebody, and that, you know, just to streamline across institutions. In one of your prior podcasts, they talked about Southern California and the differences between UCSD and UCLA and USC. And we see it. I mean, I'm sitting here in an office on 77th and Park, and there are 10 institutions within six blocks of me, and they all have wildly different tech transfer offices. And so it's a big problem, and it really minimizes the cross-fertilization between those institutions. And frankly, everyone is very, very paranoid of each other. So there has to be obviously protection for the institution, protection for the inventor, but there has to be a streamlined process. And the only way I can foresee that happening is under a federal program. But, you know, again, this would be, you know, regional offices, obviously, that are subject to also their own bureaucracies.
Wouldn't it be amazing if you were to be able to create a federated model where you have, for example, all the invention database in one central location, all the data is harmonized, it's visible to people so people can search it, it's discoverable. The data is augmented because as soon as you go into any website on a tech transfer site, that the information you're looking at is old, right? Because it's the patent information or whoever. And then also, whoever thought about that invention, they didn't think about the other 10 applications for that invention. So they're describing it in terms that they, so if you could create a database like this, augment the data, list all the different applications that particular invention have, and then also perform the due diligence in a centralized place where you have actually then a prioritization of the inventions based on due diligence factors that people could actually filter through. And then maybe you had the federated model, you have the regional locations in different areas that actually have standards and governance to make common the licensing agreement, for example, because, you know, every time you know, Pfizer wants to go to a different tech transfer office, they're going to deal with a completely different licensing agreement each time. And then on top of that, sorry, I keep going. On top of that, if Pfizer goes to XYZ organization or a startup goes to XYZ organization, you know, Pfizer's going to be charged $5 million. The startup's going to be charged, you know, $2,000. So there's also a wide range of different deals depending upon who you're dealing with. And since the inventions are also already paid for, they should be advanced from my perspective. What do you think about that idea?
I mean, I think it's terrific. It's very similar to what you enunciated better than I did.
Oh, okay.
that's exactly what I would envision because right now the current strategies are impossible. They're very siloed, very local. Even individuals within the same tech transfer office have variabilities and
that's right. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
And really what I've learned most about generating my team, including my tech transfer office, is I bring people with me that have proven success and have been great to work with, and we keep them together. We as I always say, is we have burial plots already lined up.
We're gonna
stay together forever.
You have your tribe. By the way, we've experienced that a lot as well. When we go to tech transfer offices, we have, you know, the people that we have worked with before. We know how they operate. We know if they're going to do a licensing agreement fast or it's going to take a couple of years. Going back to your point on paranoia, so that's new to me. I'd love to hear your perspective on what drives that.
So I think that I'll give you a classic example. I'm an open, transparent person. But when we come to basic science discoveries, where I want to, and obviously we're not talking about necessarily IP or patent, everything is protected. But when it comes time to present, we want to get the data out, for example, basic science research. A lot of the basic scientists are very, very paranoid about any leak of any data. Because all basic researchers now are being paid essentially by NIH dollars that they bring in. Mm-hmm. So you're paid by your R01 salary.
Right. Yeah.
And they're so paranoid about losing that line of salary support, basically their support, that they have become increasingly paranoid. And this is why you see, whether it's scientists in Korea, you know, doctoring data, that has become the pay line for our whole scientific community. And it's terrible. In fact, we just bought, our health system just bought Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories, right? Mm-hmm. Home of eight Nobel laureates, all right? So we pay Cold Spring Harbor, we are a $12 billion organization. Mm-hmm. We're paying Cold Spring Harbor about $120 million over 10 years. Now, why did they want that deal? Two reasons. One, they want to take the pressure off their researchers because NIH dollars are dwindling. Mm-hmm. So they have another revenue source and they need access to human patients. So Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories is not a human facility, and our health system is the largest health system in New York State. So, but you can see that the financial models have changed as NIH dollars have shrunk to make the lives of the scientists really, really challenging.
Mm.
And so I think that in the scientific community has fueled a huge amount of paranoia.
Wow. Okay. That's
And I'm just going to say that also comes back to clinicians and doctors that, you know, we live in a very competitive environment. And so I need to do better than my competitors in order for me to stay relevant. And some people interpret that as I have to protect what I'm doing and make sure no one else can do what I do.
Mm-hmm. Right. It makes sense. Human nature to a certain extent.
Human nature.
So I have a final question for you. Have you heard of Jordan Peterson?
No.
He came up with this book, The Rules for Life. And it seems to me that you would have a great rule for life. I mean, you have some of these great perspectives from that you've mentioned from your father. And I just think that you have, there's a really good one that you have there. And I want to hear what it is.
Okay. You're putting me on the spot. This is not one of our, it's a very good question. I stand by two simple paradigms in my life. One is tradition and family go hand in hand. So I'm constantly motivated by tradition and family in my life. So tradition and family trumps all. If I have a choice between being at work or if one of my kids needs me at home, I've learned from a very young age that you're only as productive as your family is stable. So that's my sort of rule. And that's the rule I tell all of my staff, whether it's my secretary who's having trouble because her, you know, I need her to be home. It's okay if our phones go unanswered because she will not be productive the next day if she doesn't get home to her kids. So I've lived the my rule for life is essentially family first. Okay. I know it sounds hard to believe, but I really believe that. And I get home, and if I have to work at home, I do it. So that's really the most important rule I live by. And coupled with that is stress reduction is an extremely important part of my life and my staff's life. We study mindfulness training. We offer mindfulness training to all of our employees. We do a mindful moment before every surgery in our operating room where we take a moment after our surgical timeout where we all center ourselves in our breath. And we do that together as a team with the patient under anesthesia just for a minute. Mm. So those kind of techniques, we believe in stress reduction. And part of this is to generate a feeling amongst our staff that we all care about each other's well-being. Mm-hmm. At this age of opioid addiction and suicide, and that we all care about each other, and we're all here for a common good. And those are really, they go hand in hand, but they're really stress reduction principles and family support are a big part of what makes us tick.
And you mentioned tradition as well. How does that play in?
You know, I find that I'm a sentimental person and a nostalgic person, and I've been through some painful experiences with when my father was sick. And so, but I'm motivated by the tradition of my ancestors and 100 years of medicine in my family. And I can only wish that, you know, God forbid when I'm older and sicker and that my children have the opportunity to give treatments that I could have provided for my father. So I'm motivated by what he did for his patients. I'll never forget the moments when we'd walk into a restaurant and someone would recognize him and say, "Hi, Dr. Bookvar, thank you so much." And those are very passionate moments as a child. And some of the best things that I think of is when I have a patient who says, "You know, I knew your father, he was my ophthalmologist."
Wow.
And those things are really powerful tools.
Priceless, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you would like to leave the audience with today?
We sound pretty negative, right? So we're talking about stress and, you know, policies and doctors who are burnt out and researchers that are paranoid. But
you summarize it beautifully. I was going to do that summary.
Yeah, no, I walk into work so optimistic every day. And I am blessed. I'm in an environment where I can do surgery. I can do basic science research. I come from a lab meeting just now where we're studying, tumor-associated macrophages, you know, and then I walk into a clinical trial in humans. So there is a lot of optimism. I think what you're doing with your challenges in CAI and what I think the world is recognizing is that the people that need to be in the room, I think, Steve Jobs said, innovation is not just a great idea, it's great execution. And you're helping us do that in ways where there are less barriers, less red tape, getting the right people to interact together. And I think with people like you leading these charges, we're going to do better. And there is optimism about righting the ship.
Thank you very much. It's very kind. I am blessed to have a fabulous team too. But it is about not just having the idea, but executing like crazy. Yeah. So I am just so grateful for your time today, your valuable insights. Sorry to throw that hook in there at the end, but I knew you had a good one. So I wouldn't have done it had I not believed that you're going to share some incredible, valuable insights with the audience. So thank you again so much and have a fabulous rest of your day. And by the way, John does have something really cool coming out. We'll come back around in January.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.